this morning, U.S. versus Connor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Marcus Wester, and I represent the appellant, Arthur Connor. Excuse me. Mr. Connor was charged and convicted of one count of knowingly and intentionally distributing 5 or more grams of a mixture or substance containing crack cocaine on or about December 20th of 2006. In this appeal, Mr. Connor essentially raises three issues regarding errors in his one-day trial and one issue in the alternative with regards to his sentencing. First, the district court abused its discretion in admitting a multitude of unreliable pieces of evidence of prior bad acts which were not related to the charged offense in violation of rules 404B and 403. Second, the government inexplicably gave the jury an instruction of evidence of prior, regarding aiding and abetting, even though he was not tried for such an offense, and in fact, the words aiding and abetting were never once mentioned throughout the duration of the trial. Third, even if these errors, taken individually, are found to be harmless, cumulatively they resulted in Mr. Connor being unable to have a fair trial, especially considering the short length of the trial and the small amount of evidence presented related to the charged crime itself. Finally, in the event that this court declines to grant Mr. Connor a new trial, this case should be remanded to the district court in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Kimbrough, as Mr. Connor's trial counsel properly raised the issue of changes in the 100-to-1 ratio in the sentencing guidelines, and there's no indication in the record that the district court would have imposed the same sentence had it known it had the discretion under Kimbrough to fashion a lower sentence based upon the crack powder disparity in the sentencing guidelines. First, with regards to the prior bad acts evidence presented, Mr. Connor's one-day trial was not completely focused, unfortunately, on the crime with which he was charged. But instead,
here you got two fellows who plead guilty and they testify against him. And isn't that pretty typical? The relationship of everybody is always brought out in a trial like this. I don't know anything unusual here about that.
I understand, and I think that the reason that it is that it was especially egregious here was because, in fact, Mr. Connor was not charged with conspiracy. He was merely charged with one delivery on one occasion. And
but you want to limit the trial just to that one little incident, and judges ordinarily don't do that.
Right, and understood, and of course there needed to be some evidence, I think, to come in to establish the relationship between Mr. Connor, Mr. Hughes, and, arguably not necessarily to bring in the relationship with Mr. Robeson, but especially with Mr. Hughes, I think the government certainly could have brought in evidence of the relationship between the two of them in a much more limited fashion that wouldn't have been prejudicial to Mr. Connor. They had known each other their entire lives. In fact, Mr. Hughes testified that they had been close acquaintances their entire lives. I think just testifying as to that relationship and the fact that they did have a business relationship in itself would have been sufficient, and there wasn't a need for all this testimony of events that occurred, some instances 10 years prior to the charge offense, and in many instances involved completely different players, completely different instances, locations, etc. The government introduced two main categories of alleged prior bad acts of Mr. Connor. First, the testimony I just spoke of with from Mr. Hughes and Mr. Robeson, his co-defendants, regarding their history of drug transactions with Mr. Connor. Secondly, they also introduced quite a bit of evidence, quite a bit of testimony, regarding the events of January 10, 2007, an event that was an event that only apparently involved Mr. Connor through the accusations of Mr. Hughes that he called Mr. Connor, and Mr. Connor referred him to Mr. Robeson, and they apparently obtained crack cocaine on that date through Mr. Robeson. The government argued that the evidence of the prior drug transactions with Hughes and Robeson was intricately related because it provided context to the jury and rebutted Mr. Connor's mere presence defense. This evidence was not intricately related. First, Mr. Connor was not charged, unlike the defendants in most of the cases cited by the government, and as I stated earlier, with conspiracy. Instead, like the defendant in United States versus Simpson, he was charged with delivery on one isolated occasion. The prior bad acts evidence introduced, including Hughes and Robeson's testimony regarding allegedly seeing Mr. Connor rocking and bagging crack cocaine at various locations, and were events that occurred, as I stated earlier, in some instances over 10 years prior to the charged offense. These were not; these were unrelated to the isolated event that we were, the isolated crime with which Mr. Connor was charged, and were not necessary to provide a context to the jury. They were not intricately related. They were not a missing piece of the puzzle or something necessary to create a timeline of the events here. The government similarly argued that evidence of the January 10, 2007 transaction, which took up roughly 20 pages worth of direct testimony by the government's witnesses, involved Mr. Connor because Hughes alleged that Mr. Connor instructed him over the phone to get drugs to Robeson. And they state that the government states that this was intricately related because it showed the charged crime was not an isolated event with strangers and corroborated both Mr. Hughes and Mr. Robeson's testimony. However, this testimony was highly prejudicial, unreliable, and irrelevant as it involved an accusation that Mr. Connor told Mr. Hughes to get crack from Robeson with no evidence to support the existence of such a conversation. Furthermore, it did not complete the story of December 20th, nor did it provide necessary context. The January 10th, 2007 transaction did not involve the same quote-unquote players, did not involve the same location, and did not involve the same modus operandi. Together, the prior bad act testimony introduced constituted essentially half of the government's evidence in a one-day trial. It is apparent that the government had little evidence regarding the alleged crime, the events related to December 20th, and consequently focused on evidence which painted Mr. Connor as a career drug dealer. This evidence was unreliable, as it was uncorroborated testimony by interested witnesses who received reduced sentences in exchange for testifying against Mr. Connor. Was inadmissible under 404B as it was not intricately related to the charged offense, which was a single count of distribution on one isolated occasion, and was unduly prejudicial as it had the effect of bombarding the jury with evidence of Mr. Connor's alleged occupation rather than evidence directly relevant to the events of December 20th, 2006. As in Owens and Simpsons, the prior bad acts evidence introduced was not necessary to complete the story of the crime or for any other purpose allowed under 404B. Mr. Connor acknowledges knowing Mr. Hughes for many years and vice versa. Furthermore, Mr. Connor never placed intent or knowledge at issue, contending from the outset that he did not possess or sell any drugs on December 20th of 2006. He acknowledged that the package recovered from Mr. Harriel contained crack cocaine. He did not argue that he possessed these drugs and merely lacked the intent to deliver. He argued that he never possessed the drugs at all and was not present or a participant to any drug transaction on December 20th of 2006. Secondly, with regards to the aiding and abetting instruction given to the jury, Mr. Connor also argues that his right to a fair trial was compromised when the government instructed the jury regarding the elements of a conviction for aiding and abetting when he was not tried for such a crime. As a result of this instruction, which raised a charge that had not been mentioned a single time throughout the trial.
Didn't his counsel say that's the instruction that should be used?
I'm sorry?
Counsel say that's the instruction that should be used?
Yes, she did agree to the instruction, and so this would be a plain error review. We would argue that giving this instruction, considering the fact that aiding and abetting wasn't mentioned a single time throughout trial, was extremely prejudicial to Mr. Connor and resulted in a result in which we don't know whether the jury convicted him of aiding and abetting or whether, in fact, they convicted him of the charged offense, which was one, which was the intentional distribution of crack cocaine on December 20th. If there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Graber.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honor. My name is Dan Graber. I represent the United States. I was also the trial attorney down below in the trial of Mr. Kahn. The first issue that I'd like to address is the argument counsel makes with regards to it not being intricately related because we didn't charge out a conspiracy in this case. Connor was charged with the one count of distribution on December the 20th. We brought in evidence under the intricately related theory about his prior drug activity with his co-defendants. Counsel argues because we didn't charge a conspiracy, that can't come in. We grounded our theory, Your Honor. Usually when you look at the cases, and I cite them in my brief about McLee, Luster, Gugis, those types of cases that talk about when you bring that pre-conspiracy conduct in, that pre-relationship conduct in, and there's a charged conspiracy, usually it's relevant under the intricately related doctrine because you're going to prove an element of the offense. In this case, a charged conspiracy. Did the defendant knowingly and intentionally join in that conspiracy? So in those cases, the government is grounding its intricately related argument on the prong that you have out in your... The doctrine has a number of prongs, and one of the prongs in the doctrine is, does it tend to prove an established an element in the charged crime? We were grounding our theory under it tends to show the surrounding circumstances of the crime charged, and that's where we were grounding. And the reason that's important, and the reason we got into the kind of detail that counsel's talking about, is because corroboration of the witnesses, the credibility of the witnesses became very important.
So is it your position that corroborating a witness's testimony is an exception to the presumption in 404B against introducing propensity evidence?
No, I'm arguing, Your Honor, that in our case we had to prove three elements, one of which was distribution. And in this case, he was arguing, I didn't distribute that cocaine in that car on that day. They're setting me up. These two guys are liars. They're drug dealers. Don't believe them. So he threw their credibility into issue, and that's what distinguishes this case from, for example, Owens, that defense counsel cites, too, where the court talks about, look, you've got this prior act. In that case, it was the 95 bank robbery. He was charged only with the 2002 bank robbery, but the government brought in the fact that he knew about the bank and robbing the bank in the past because he had done it before. And, Your Honor, if you, in that case, the court says, look, these concepts of trying to corroborate the government's witness by showing the detail is a valid basis under this theory. Completing the story is a valid theory under this, is a valid reason under this theory. But
okay,
it's
but one of the things you said with respect to the January 10th deal, you argued in rebuttal that the second buy corroborates the first buy. It shows that it's not just an isolated incident. That's why it's in here. That's why it's presented to you. Isn't that more of a propensity argument than what you're suggesting, which is, you know, this was brought in to show that they had this relationship, and therefore you can believe these witnesses.
We
their earlier dealings with him.
Your Honor, I brought in that second buy strictly for corroboration. What I had was Harriel and Hughes, two eyewitnesses in the car on December 20th, implicating Art Connor, saying Art Connor sold me those drugs in the car on the 20th. Now their credibility is in question because he's saying, I'm not the guy, some other guy did it. And you'll see they try to either put it off on Mike Hughes or his cousin Vernon Hughes. I've got an event 20 days later where Harriel and Hughes again are saying that Art Connor is selling drugs. Harriel says, I call up Art Connor to buy drugs, and Art says, yeah, I'll sell you drugs. I'll call you right back. He doesn't. So then Harriel calls up Mike Hughes, and Mike Hughes says, yeah, I can hook you up. Mike Hughes calls up Art Connor, gets a hold of him, and Art says, well, I don't have it with me right now. I'm holding it with my guy, Derek Robeson. Call Robeson. He'll give it to you. He's got 3-8 balls that he's holding for me. And sure enough, Robeson now comes in as a corroborating witness to say, yes, actually, the buy did happen, and yes, Art Connor did call me. Mike Hughes called me. We set up the deal, and the deal took place. So that second event, Your Honor, was done as corroboration to corroborate Harriel and Hughes by showing that they weren't lying about that first event on the 20th. Which,
so it would be your position that there should be no 404B analysis in getting this admitted, that you would rest on this inextricably intertwined doctrine that usually rises out of conspiracy cases?
No, Your Honor. To the opposite. When I at the district court level, I did two theories. First theory was intricately related. The backup theory of admissibility, Your Honor, that I moved under was 404B, and I argued both to the court. Now, the district court just ruled on intricate related and didn't have rule on 404B. I am saying in the brief, Your Honor, that there is, if there was any error under the intricate related doctrine, it's saved. There is, it's harmless because it still would be admissible under 404B, because I think it would prove under the exception of 404B both knowledge as well as absence of mistake and accident. And I think last month the court came out with two decisions dealing with this issue, Harris and Fleming, where the court did exactly this type of analysis and said, look, this intricately related doctrine may be a bit vague, but it, you know, everything that you can get in under intricately related, you seem to be able to get under in under 404B's exception, so we'll just analyze it under 404B and do the four-pronged analysis. And under that analysis, Your Honor, we believe that the evidence is admissible both to show Connor's knowledge as well as Connor's absence of mistake, again, because he's saying, I don't know what you guys are talking about. I wasn't the one that sold drugs. There's a point that I'd like to make. Counsel argued that Art Connor never put intent and knowledge into play because Art Connor said he was never in the car. That's simply wrong, Your Honor. That was never argued to the jury. That was Art Connor was in that car. Art Connor knew he was in the car. We had a tape of Art Connor in that car. It was a 23-minute buy. The first 20 minutes are without Art Connor. It's just Harriel and Hughes, and then this Vernon Hughes shows up, and they're talking. The last 3 minutes is when Art Connor shows up, and the drug deal goes through, and that's when Harriel gets out of the car because now he has the drugs that
Doesn't
he was.
That really fit more under 404B and rather than an inextricably intertwined?
Correct, it does, Your Honor, and that's why I argued that as a backup theory of admissibility.
And that's what I'm trying to get at. It seems to me you're on much safer ground on the 404B analysis than this inextricably intertwined.
And, Your Honor, that is why I made that secondary argument, and that's why when I read the post-Taylor cases that are coming from the circuit in the last month, it would appear the circuit seems to be going towards away from the intricately related doctrine and more into 404B and the exceptions under 404B, which I think in this case we can meet in this case.
This December drug sale, the crack cocaine was worth, what, $180?
Correct. Yes, it was 3-8 balls that he purchased.
And his sentence was life imprisonment, wasn't it?
Well, Your Honor, his sentence was life imprisonment, but that we had a...
He has a record, but I just wanted to confirm the value.
Correct. In this case, we had a contested sentencing hearing. The relevant conduct finding by the court, the defense argued that the relevant conduct drug amount was 1.7 kilos. We argued 7.65 kilos of crack cocaine. The court said, look, anything over 1.5, you're pegged out at the top at a level 38. So the court found that it was over 1.5 kilos for relevant conduct.
You concede that it has to go back under Kimbrough, don't you?
It does, Your Honor. But, you know, I'd like to point out to you, it does have to go back on Kimbrough because defense counsel did preserve that Kimbrough objection, and I argued actually against it because at the time the law in the circuit under Joinder was that they couldn't do that, and so I argued that, and Kimbrough overruled that. So the district court never commented one way or the other on the Kimbrough 100-1, so I think it should come back so that the court can take that discretion into account. But, you know, he was at a level 42 at a Category 6.
Judge Shabazz still hearing these cases?
No.
So this one, I go back to Judge Kraft.
Yep.
Then.
Yep.
Well, I think we can leave that since you agree that it should go back. We don't need to make any further argument to us with regard to that.
Okay. If you don't have anything further, any other questions, then I'll rest. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Wester.
Just a very brief rebuttal. I'll just address a couple of issues very quickly. Just to clarify, as far as if I stated that Mr. Connor was never in the car, that was a mistake. I did not mean to state that. His argument was that he was not present. It wasn't an instance where he merely witnessed. He never made a mere bystander argument. He argued that he was never present for any drug transaction on December the 20th. He did acknowledge going into that car, but he did not state that while he was in the car he saw a drug transaction involving other individuals, or that he, I mean, it wasn't, I also believe that he didn't make knowledge an issue because it wasn't as if he stated, yes, I gave a package to Mr. Harriel, but I did not know it was crack cocaine. In fact, he stipulated that the evidence recovered from the scene was, in fact, crack cocaine. Very briefly, we feel, under the 404B analysis, this evidence fails under multiple prongs. As far as it establishing a matter at issue, I think we've addressed those arguments, but it is clear that Mr. Connor's argument was not a mere bystander or innocent bystander defense. He did not contest that the item recovered from the scene was crack cocaine. This was not an instance where he was arrested with crack cocaine on his person, and the issue was, did he possess with the intent to distribute? He contends that he never possessed any crack cocaine. As far as the second prong of 404B, we feel that this evidence was not similar or close in time. The January 10th transaction involved, as I stated earlier, different individuals. It did not involve Mr. Connor outside of the sketchy details of a phone call being placed to him and him referring to go and get it from Mr. Robeson. Third of all, we do not believe that the evidence was sufficient to support a jury finding as far as the evidence that was introduced. The January 10th transaction was merely the evidence of different individuals regarding a phone call. We do not believe that would have been sufficient to find a jury to support a jury finding on that issue. And finally, we feel that this evidence under 403 was more prejudicial than probative, was unduly prejudicial. It deprived Mr. Connor of a fair trial by, essentially taking his one-day trial and instead of making it on the events of December 20th, making it on his entire alleged career and all of these all this history between Mr. Connor and other individuals through testimony of individuals who did receive bargains from the government on as a result of their testimony against Mr. Connor. If there are no further questions, we rest. Thank you.
Mr. Lester, you took this case by appointment, did you?
Yes, I did.
You have the thanks of the court for your able representation of your client.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Move to the